Morning Brew, the Friday edition, from 5 to 8 a.m. on member-supported WPFW Washington, 89.3 FM.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Phyllis Bennis. Phyllis Bennis is the author of Understanding Palestine and Israel. She's also a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. How are you doing this way, Phyllis?
Great to be with you, Ethelbert.
All right. Your new book seems to be an expansion of the work you did back in 2009. That year you published Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, a primer. Why did you decide to do that primer back in 2009? I know you've done a number of primers, but why that one in 2009?
You know, that one, when it came out in 2009, was already actually the third edition, because I had done it as a set of pamphlets early on. Because we realized in the first maybe 10 years of the 21st century, that people, including a lot of people who were working on the issue of Palestinian rights, just didn't know a lot of the history. It was hard to find. And it was particularly tricky because we grow up in a country where everybody, certainly, you know, for me growing up as a Jewish kid, but for everybody I knew, you grew up thinking you knew everything you needed to know about Israel. Because it was so ever present in our education from kindergarten on up, age appropriate lessons about Israel, about the history. And people think that's all they need to know. They see what's in the papers, they see what's in their school books. And then when I learned later that there was a lot of misinformation in that massive education plan, I realized it was also going to be hard to reach people because people think they know stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would sometimes talk about it or think about it in the context of the genocide in Rwanda in 1994. When that broke, and of course it was nothing like the genocide in Gaza, at least in many ways, but it was not something that was visible to most people. We had no social media, we didn't have, you know, 24/7 news coverage. But people started to hear about it and to ask questions. Where's Rwanda? What is this place? Everybody knew they knew nothing.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with talking about Israel and Palestine is that people often think they know everything and they have a very strong position. So it's partly about challenging people to rethink what they already thought before you give new information.
Well, you know, when I looked at your book, I thought that back in the primer 2009, I thought that this was a book for the media people, especially activists, and then maybe teachers.
Yes and no. Okay. I think all of those groups, I hope, found it useful. But I was actually writing for a different audience. And you see some of it in the difference in tone that one. By the time of I even started thinking about the new book, we had started thinking about whether I should write an eighth version of that one. They had gone through 7 updates, right? The last one in 2019, 10 years after the first one came out. Every 2 years, we do a new one, right? And that early one was really aimed at people who were starting to feel like, maybe I didn't get all of this right, but I don't really know anything. And so the language was deliberately done in a way that assumed nothing. It was very neutral. It was very neutral language. And I tried to actually use some of the language that I saw in the media. So I remember one of the questions, it was done in the form of FAQs, frequently asked questions. One of the questions was some version, I don't remember exactly, but something like, why did Arafat reject Ehud Barak's generous offer? And when some of my Palestinian friends saw an early draft, they got very sort of irritated with that. Said, "Why did you say that? It wasn't a generous offer." I said, "Of course it wasn't, but that's in the answer. And if I had said, you know, explain why Arafat rejected the completely unfair offer that was being the only thing given to him, who would have read that? You know, you might have, but you don't need it. You know it, right?" Mm-hmm. So it was really aimed at people who knew something, but maybe had a lot of it wrong, and were just opening up to a new approach.
Well, you know, when I picked up your new book, Understanding Palestine and Israel, what I found very interesting was on page 279 in the back, you present maps that capture the diminishing lands of Palestine between 1947 to 2003. The last map was like 22 years ago. It
Yeah.
seemed Palestine is being erased. You know, what can be done to stop this reversing?
That's exactly a crucial question, Ethelbert. Thank you for that. That map we used in the in one of the earlier books, and it was just put in, you know, because it was there, that set of maps. But the notion of erasure is exactly right, and it's exactly contemporary. You can say, and I would argue that from even before what Palestinians call the Nakba, the catastrophe of 1948, when the State of Israel was created and 750,000 Palestinians were expelled from their land, dispossessed of all they had known for generations, and never allowed to return. You could say that that was the beginning of the process of erasing Palestine, replacing it with something else, replacing it with a quote Jewish state. And that went on and continues to go on now. We're seeing it now in Gaza. What we're seeing just in the last 2 or 3 months, this effort to move everybody who has survived in Gaza, and there is, you know, probably more than 200,000 people who have been killed. We don't know for sure. According to The Lancet, it was at least over 85, I think was the 85,000 was their number, estimates from months and months ago. The official number that has been documented personally, one person with name and birth date and ID number, is 56,000. I mean, it's incomprehensible. But all that have survived are now being pushed, physically pushed into the one tiny little corner of southwest Gaza, of this tiny little strip. There are now somewhere close to 1.5 million people crammed into this little area that has no water available, has no almost no housing, virtually no food, where people are now dying of starvation as well as being killed by the bombs. This is about erasing that population.
And
Another
this is when you look up, you know, I remember when I was growing up in school in the South Bronx, you know, maps were very important to look at, you know. And then I remember people like say, well, the Mercator project map, or not really, you know, the United States is not really this
Not that big,
big, right?
right.
You know, and then
Yeah.
you had to, but so maps are, I found that, and I went straight to that, and I found it interesting. I want to take it back. The world changed on October 7, 2023. How did you respond when you first heard the news? And what concerns did you have back then?
I think it's important to put this in a slightly different context, in the
Okay.
same way that I don't think the world changed on September 11th.
Right.
I think the world changed on September 12th when George Bush announced what his response was going to be to this horrific crime that had been committed. When I heard about what was going on October 7th, I was shocked because it had never happened before at that scale. I was not surprised because I knew the conditions in Gaza that people were living under, and the expectation of an explosion had been publicly discussed for 15 years. You know, back in 2012, the United Nations had said that by 2020, Gaza will be, quote, unlivable. Then in 2018, they changed their position and said Gaza is now unlivable. It was like, okay, what are you going to do about it? There's still 2.3 million people living there, half of them children. So when I heard about it, my first thought was, oh my God, this is terrible, because a number of civilians had been killed. It was terrible. And that was a huge crime, the killing of civilians. What was not a crime, what is in fact legal under international law, which was something very hard for, I think, a lot of people to envision, because what we were seeing was horrific, was that for an occupied population to rise up and attack, including with the use of military force, the military forces occupying their country is a legal act of resistance. We never heard that in the US. We still don't, except in very rare circumstances within the Palestinian community, among supporters of Palestinian rights. Very few people are willing to acknowledge that of the about 1,140 people who were killed on that day, about 800 of them were civilians. That was illegal. It was a crime. It was unacceptable. And there were about 340 people who were killed who were soldiers, and some were militarized police. That was not a crime. Tragic, yes, of course. When any young soldiers are killed in by on any side in any war, it's always tragic. It's always the young who die. But I think that understanding it in the context of what were the conditions in Palestine in general, but particularly in Gaza, that gave rise to this. For those of us who work on this issue as a big part of what we do day to day, hour to hour, it was not surprising. It was shocking, but it was not surprising. And then my first thought within that first couple of hours was, oh my God, this is going to breed a horrific response. I never imagined, I must say, it would be as bad as it was. I never imagined that we would see the evidence of genocide in a way, you know, genocide, I think, is a very hard crime to prove. And it's why it's rarely talked about, because you not only have to have certain acts of violence. You don't have to kill everybody, but you do have to do acts of violence that are aimed at destroying a particular group. That happens a lot in the world. But what doesn't happen a lot is being able to prove that the intention was to destroy that group. And what was different here was that right from day one, from October 7th, that night, we were hearing the first speeches saying, we will kill them all, children included. There are no innocents. This is not about just Hamas. This is about the people of Gaza. They are all guilty. We will kill them all. And for me, the thing that struck me that night, and I think I quoted it in the book, it reminded me of the language of the Indian Wars in this country. And there's a famous one from the Battle of Sand Creek, the massacre of Sand Creek, more appropriately, in 1860 in Colorado. When the commander of a group of US soldiers, he happened to be a Methodist minister as well, who ordered his soldiers to attack in the middle of the night a sleeping village on the shores of the creek. And some of his soldiers came back to him and said, "We can't do that. These are ordinary people. It's a village. There's kids, there's old people, and we promised to protect these tribes." And his answer was, "Nits make lives, kill them all. Even the children." And I thought, this is the language we are hearing now. So it felt very familiar in that sense.
You have, Phyllis Bennett, you have in your book, Understanding Palestine and Israel, you have about 8 pages that list resources, folks can learn more about. What organization or individuals did you immediately reach out to determine what was going on back in October 2003? Was there any organization that you immediately, I know things are going on. Who can I talk to that I know is like boots on the ground of, actual information?
Yeah, I mean, I feel very privileged in that sense because I spent a lot of time in the occupied territories in the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem during the first uprising, the first Intifada, in the period from about 1988 until about two, well, about, I guess, about 1990, something like that. So I had a lot of individual contacts. I just get on the phone and call people. The organizations that I know, particularly now that we have an internet, you know, the information is so easily available. There's regular media sources like Al Jazeera, which has its issues, but on the question of Palestine, their coverage is superb. So I would often go there. Haaretz, one of the top Israeli daily newspapers, has an English language edition online. It's always one of the best sources around for what's happening in the occupied Palestinian territories inside Israel. So that's very important. I would also always read a bunch of the Israeli press, the Israeli Jewish English language press, which I virtually never agree with. I usually don't even agree with their assessment of what's happening on the ground because I know a different version from people there. But I need to know what Jewish Israelis are hearing and learning and accepting as true. So when we hear things, for example, just in the last week, there was a new poll indicating that 82%, sorry, 86, 82% of Israeli Jews agreed with the attack on Iran. Not because anything had changed, not because there was some imminent attack from Iran going on at that time, just because there had been so much propaganda about Iran as an existential threat to Israelis that they were immediately willing to accept it. So I go to a lot of those sources. Here in the United States, organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace, routinely has important, good information on their website. The global organization, Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions Movement, which is led by Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, in their website, there's always good information about new developments. So it's not as hard these days to find that information. It just means people have to be willing to go a little bit beyond the New York Times and CNN.
Right.
Obviously Now, which we just were listening to, is always a great source for Palestinian information.
I want to go back to what is in your book, and you were talking about it, and that is that many people did not look at the fact that military installations were being attacked. Okay. But people did get caught up with the fact that a large body of the civilians were attending this supernova music festival. And so you have that concern. But then there's something I want to add. You have not just killing, you also have the taking of hostages. Okay. You mentioned in your own book that the taking of hostages is a war crime. Talk about that.
You know, the notion that there are laws of war is a kind of very strange concept, but they do exist. It's a it's a set of laws known as international humanitarian law, IHL. A lot of it is very wonky and it's kind of designed for ordinary people not to really understand what it means. But it's things like the Geneva Conventions, it's things like that, that kind of recognizes that war is going to go on and sets parameters that you can't go beyond certain things. Certain things are war crimes. Certain things are crimes against humanity. They are so horrific. Genocide is a crime against humanity. Apartheid is a crime against humanity. Things like collective punishment, something the Israelis are incredibly good at, punishing an entire population for the actions of 100 people, whatever it is. So one of those restrictions is on taking hostages. That's not okay. That's not okay. That did happen. And one of the things that I think is important to recognize is that this attack of October 7th, which was led by Hamas, also involved a lot of other people, young men who followed Hamas once when they broke down the wall, this wall that had encircled the Gaza Strip for 17 years. So you had young people, young men in there who were 18, 19, 20 years old, who had lived their entire conscious life in this tiny little open air prison, had never been beyond the wall. And when suddenly the wall is broken open, no surprise that they rushed in. And there was anger, there was fury. Whether all of those crimes against civilians were carried out by those young people who were not part of Hamas is certainly a possibility. We certainly don't know that, but that's one possibility. It was unacceptable going after young people at a music concert. You know, this is not okay. The other thing that is important, which I touch on in the book as well, is that there is a longstanding policy in the Israeli military that they will approve the killing of their own colleagues, their own soldiers, to avoid them being captured by the enemy. There is evidence now that that doctrine was applied in Gaza to civilians. We know that in the kibbutzim that were attacked, there was an initial attack. The first attacks were on military, several, three different military bases. After that, there were two different kibbutzim that were attacked. In those attacks, there was significant evidence of tank fire and fire from the air against houses, against parts of the kibbutzim, which certainly didn't come from Hamas or anybody else in Gaza. They didn't have any of that. That was because the Israeli military that was fighting against the people who had come in from Gaza were using their own weapons as a military force, their own weapons of war. And people were killed by their own forces in what is known as friendly fire. I don't think there's a full accounting yet of the numbers, but all of that was going on that day.
You, Phyllis Bennett, worked for many years with the UN. I have a problem with the organization.
I didn't work for the
UN. No. Well, you were at the UN. You were in New York.
Okay. I was in New York.
Okay. But you observed a lot of these, and you mentioned a few minutes ago, we were talking about these international agencies. To me, no one pays any attention to them. You know, I mean, you know, I think that The UN needs to be, reinvented again. It's like back to the old day of League of Nations or whatever. But what is your opinion today in terms of one, the way it's structured, we can't even pass anything because it gets vetoed by, one of the major powers in the Security Council?
Well, if you hadn't asked me that, I would have paid you to ask me that because that's such a great question. And there's a whole long history of it. I wrote a book years ago called Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates Our Today's UN, right? You could use the same title today, 25 years later, 30, what am I saying? 30 years later. God, it's a long time ago.
Right.
That hasn't changed. But what has changed is there's been a lot of effort that some of which has been very successful to use the UN going around those limitations that were built into it. This was a product of the victors of World War II, and they were going to be damn sure that they kept the privilege of victors, victors' justice and victors' power. So the five veto-holding countries of the Security Council, the US, Russia, China, Britain, France, those were the victors of World War II. Why are they the ones rather than the giant countries? Why not India? Why not South Africa? Why not any of these countries? It's because that's who won the war. That's who makes the peace. But what happened over time was that there began to be more and more challenges of that. So that power relation remains. That's by far the least democratic and the most powerful part of the UN. The General Assembly, arguably the most democratic, has the least amount of power to implement what it passes. But we learned a huge lesson in the 1980s in the struggle against South African apartheid, when people all around the world were building this anti-apartheid movement to support the struggle of the South Africans themselves to overcome apartheid. And the UN was a big component of that. That was in the era of decolonization. A lot of this was happening at the UN. The UN had a special committee against apartheid. It had the Center Against Apartheid that was doing all this stuff, helping these social movements around the world, stay in touch with each other, stay together, share resources, all of that. And one of the things that happened was that a lot of resolutions would come to the Security Council. They'd be vetoed by the US, sometimes the Brits, but mainly by the US. One third of all the US vetoes cast from 1970 until today, one third were cast in support of South Africa to prevent sanctions against South Africa, right? So they were doing it all the time, once a week, twice a week, three times a week, whatever. So then it would go to the General Assembly, and the General Assembly passed amazing resolutions calling for banking sanctions and trade sanctions, arms embargo, really important, arms embargo against apartheid South Africa. And the US would shrug and say, well, we don't care, that's not enforceable, right? It's just an advisory opinion. But all around the world, these movements would take that as a tool for their mobilizing and get their governments to pass laws imposing all those things. So country by country by country separately, they were passing all kinds of sanctions. They were stopping arms sales, all of that. And eventually that's what put enough pressure on the US that they were forced to impose sanctions as well after a lot of struggle here, of course. But that's the model that we're talking about now. So the International Court of Justice for the first time becomes a venue. South Africa decides enough with this stuff of only having the white colonial countries have access to these institutions. We get this institution too. So they bring charges against Israel for violating the terms of the Genocide Convention, for committing the crime of genocide. This was in November of 2003, just weeks after the genocide began. And in a very rapid pace, given that it's international agencies where it always moves very slowly, in January, the International Court of Justice issued a preliminary ruling that was extraordinarily powerful, found that it was plausible that it was genocide, what was going on, and that whether or not it was genocide, that Israel was needed to stop what it was doing, stop its military from carrying out these actions. And it issued six specific demands on Israel, none of which Israel accepted, right? So that now is underway, and there's a movement around the world of social movements that are working to figure out ways of implementing that. So then the General Assembly takes it back and they create a big, long resolution calling for a whole bunch of sanctions against Israel, not only around the genocide in Gaza, but on the basis of another opinion of the International Court of Justice, another advisory opinion that was requested by the General Assembly. They issue a bunch of recommendations that the UN should implement. that includes stop sending weapons, banking sanctions, trade sanctions, all these things. That now is a very powerful resolution of the General Assembly, and there's all kinds of campaigns underway to implement those. So that's the model. It's the model we know works. It worked around South Africa in the 80s. It can work around Israel now. And there's a lot of groups working on it.
I'm going to ask you one question before we take a break. We hear the term ceasefire, but in your book, Understanding Palestine and Israel, you break it down to like three definitions. You know, it's not just the stopping of military activity, but humanitarian aid. Talk about the definition of ceasefire according to what's in your book.
This was an extraordinary thing. In that section of the book, Ethelbert, I was talking about the ceasefire movement that emerged in the U.S. that was very separate from the longstanding movement for Palestinian rights that I had been part of for decades and had been around for a very long time. And that movement immediately sprung into action after we saw what Israel was doing following October 7th and was doing a lot of work. But that was different. There was this spontaneous movement of people who had mostly never thought very much about Palestine, maybe thought not very much about Israel, were either activists who were involved in climate work or women's rights or LGBTQ rights or labor rights, or you know, the anti-racist struggle, whatever it was, suddenly were seeing on their phones 24/7, this is outrageous, this is unconscionable, we can't allow this to happen. And when we know it's going on with our money, in our name, this is not okay. And people poured into the streets in their hundreds of thousands and then millions around this country, everywhere. And the demand came together, cease fire now. But very quickly, it was redefined. So that now, first of all, it was no longer just cease fire now. It was cease fire now and permanent. It's going to be a permanent ceasefire. And it has to mean three things. It has to mean, number one, yes, stop the bombing, stop the tank fire, stop killing people, stop the drones. Number two is allow in massive amounts of humanitarian aid. People are starving. They are close to death from starvation. And of course, now we have passed that. There are people who have died from starvation. And now babies are starting to die of thirst in a deliberately set drought, a human-caused drought. And then the third thing, perhaps the most important for those of us in the U.S., was stop sending weapons. That all of that was wrapped up in this demand. So you had on the one hand, a level of message discipline, which I gotta say the Palestine movement was never that good at. But this time, this movement of all kinds of people from all kinds of places were very, very disciplined. And then they redefined what that meant. So it was an extraordinary thing. And then we saw things that came out of it, the movement that challenged in the primary elections. The uncommitted movement was a product of that broad ceasefire movement. It was creative. It was incredible.
Take the ceasefire term, right? Yeah. And now apply to what we hear going on right now. And that's how does this term ceasefire apply to Tehran and Iran?
Well, right now, these are very different situations, but they're linked. They're clearly linked. Right now, there's a Trump-imposed ceasefire between Israel and Iran, which may hold. It's been holding now for about 48 hours. We don't know if it will hold. This was not a ceasefire that was negotiated and that both sides agreed to. This was something announced by Trump on his plane on social media, right? And I can imagine the leaders, frankly, of both countries saying, WTF, I won't say it on the air, but saying, what is this?
Well, he said it publicly on the air.
Yeah, I will. But you know, this was one of those things where he just announced it and there was enough influence on particularly the Israeli side that maybe he meant it this time, because what we've seen in the past has been whether it was President Biden or President Trump saying, please stop killing so many Palestinians. Trump actually didn't say that very often, but President Biden did. But of course, the Israelis had no reason to listen to it because they kept sending the weapons. So why would anybody listen to it? You know, say what you want.
But can the term ceasefire mean something? Because here it is, Trump sent bombers in. So now he's like said, okay, I can send them back again, but I'm going to stop.
That's the threat. I'm going to stop right now.
So that's his term of ceasefire.
That's the threat. This is a threatened ceasefire. Both sides agreed to it. You know, it's one of those things when people are being killed, and somewhere between 900 and 1,000 Iranians, almost all civilians, were killed during those 2 weeks of Israeli assaults. You know, it seems like it wasn't much, relative to Gaza, but that's a lot of people to be killed in airstrikes and drone strikes and assassinations, all of it. So in that context, Iran, I'm sure, was thrilled at the prospect of a ceasefire, the people of Iran especially. And in Israel, probably not as much because very few Israelis were killed. I think the total was 24. That's a very different matter than when you have 1,000 people killed. And as we saw, many more Israelis wanted the war to continue. But the call for a ceasefire was not a comprehensive ceasefire.
Okay, well,
It was
we're
not
not. We're,
designed as well.
I'm not going to call for a ceasefire because I want to have a second part of our show. Okay, so my guest today is Phyllis Bennett. She's the author of Understanding Palestine and Israel. She's also a fellow at the Institute for Policy Study. The show's on the margin. My name's Edith Burt Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
This is your social justice calendar for the week of June 23rd, 2025. Thursday, June 26th, IPS invites you to the special online screening of the documentary And Yet We Exist, Pero Si Existimos, about a powerful story of resistance against corporate exploitation and environmental harm, the case of Volcan Mining Company versus Mexico ISDS, followed by a live panel discussion 2 to 4 p.m. More info and registration is on ips-dc.org/events. Also on Thursday, June 26th at 6 p.m., Busboys and Poets on 450 K Street, Northwest Washington, D.C. presents you with a discussion powering anti-war, organizing a fundraiser for Roots Action, and defusing nuclear war. For more info, visit busboysandpoets.com. WPFW's social justice calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m. at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW's social justice calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Back in 2018, we've got Mike Huckabee, U.S. ambassador. It seems that Christian Zionism seems to be part of this expansion to the West Bank, the renaming of giving the area the biblical names. But talk about Christian Zionism, and then also link that not just to Israel, but link that to Donald Trump supporters.
Yeah, this is a hugely important issue. Christian Zionists make up a much bigger constituency to support Israel in the United States than Jewish Zionists. There's many more of them. It's one of the biggest components of the evangelical Christian movement, which is itself the biggest Christian Protestant movement in the country. So this is an incredibly important movement. And in the last, I would say, 25 years or so, it's become particularly visible and more significant politically in terms of fundraising for candidates, that sort of thing. I think when we talk about pro-Israel lobbies, people sort of assume we're talking about AIPAC and the Council of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations, and which are the traditional old pro-Israel lobbies, but the groups like CUFI, Christians United for Israel, are in fact much more powerful, much wealthier, all of those things. There's a theological basis to that, which is a little bit different than the Jewish pro and secular pro-Israel lobbies. The theological basis essentially says that the second coming of Christ is dependent on the ingathering of all the Jews in Palestine, right? This was the old biblical, I don't know the sites
You're
of
getting ready to talk about the rapture, aren't you, Phyllis?
I am, but there's a particular part of it because it's a really bad thing for Jews, because there's this notion that when the second coming of Christ happens, all the Jews, the precondition is that all the Jews have to be ingathered. That's the term, the ingathering of the
And the
Jews
capital has to be Jerusalem.
in this territory. And then the Jews will all either convert or die. So that's the part that, like, wait, what does that mean? For those of us who are Jewish, it's like, that's a hell of a choice, you know? So that's the basis of, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot more to it, obviously, but that's a big chunk of the theological basis of Christian Zionism. And it's very, very dangerous because in the US, it's rooted in and connected to Christian nationalism. which is this right-wing movement that says the United States should be a Christian Christian country, and unsaid most of the time, but sometimes said, a white Christian country. That's the goal of it. So there's a racist element to it, there's a sectarian element to it, and there's a right-wing social agenda that is very much a part of it. So it's a very big component of Trump's MAGA base, Christian Zionism. And that's why you see this weird sort of embrace of Zionism. Trump is by far the most pro-Israel president that has ever been in the context of both the amounts of money that he's sent, but also taking on the demands of the far right in Israel, which, remember, I mean, we've talked about this before, Ethelbert, that in Israel, politics has shifted overall so far to the right that Benjamin Netanyahu is one of the most left of his government, right? Because the others are so far. We have a government that's essentially a collaboration between the right, the far right, the fascist right, that is, and I use that term very deliberately, the party, for example, the Jewish Power Party, which for decades was prohibited from even running candidates because they were seen as so racist towards Arabs, even in Israel, which to be, punished for that in Israel means you have to be way, way over on the racism side. They are now in the government, two of the most powerful members of the cabinet. So in that context, Trump has embraced their demands, which was move the embassy to Jerusalem, announce that it's fine to recognize the US now officially recognizes the Israeli occupation of the Syrian Golan Heights, accept not only the existing settlements in the West Bank, but future expansion of the settlements.
Let's ask me. I want to be, you were making reference to Sandy Hook, Creek. I wonder if you look at, and this may be a concept that's been out there, I'm looking at what's happening in terms of how Israel was able to move into Syria and things of that sort. And I was looking at the West Bank. Are we talking about sort of like the greater Israel, sort of like Manifest Destiny under James K. Polk?
We are talking exactly about Manifest Destiny. We are talking exactly about an expansion of the existing settler colonialism.
Okay, hold that point. Can we take Christian Zionism, which not just from the area in terms of Israel and Palestine, but apply that to what's going on in Africa? Is there a form of Christian Zionism in Africa?
I think that was the history of settler colonialism in many parts of the world, in Africa, in Latin America. This was the basis of the doctrine of discovery, where the Pope back in the 1600s said, it's all good. Any Christian who comes across any land, any way they want it, by any means, that's not inhabited by Christians, you can have it.
Yeah, and then I add this question: when we look at some African country, and using this as some of them take a very hard line against homosexuals, and some of that seems that that's backed by the Christian,
Yes.
right?
In fact, we saw in taking it back to the current situation in the International Court of Justice, the only judge that voted against the majority, these are 15 judges, the only one who voted against either 14 or 13 other judges, they were almost unanimous across the board in that case against Israel that South Africa had brought, was the consistent judge from Uganda who voted no on every single one. No coherence, no, with no explanation. And everybody knew it's because she's a well-known Christian Zionist who will support Israel no matter what. It was an ideological and theological basis, not based on a different reading of the statutes of the International Court.
Okay, now talking about reading, and I don't think we'll have enough time to do all of this, but you asked 269 questions in your book.
Really?
And yes, 269 questions in your
Oh,
book.
okay.
And you divide your book into four sections. I wanted to take, two questions from each section, but I'll just take one question from each section. The first one is in section one, which I think is important. What is Hamas?
Okay, the short version, because if we're going to do all of them,
Right.
Hamas was an organization that began in the period around 1988 during the first uprising, the first Intifada. It was rooted in a region-wide organization known as the Muslim Brotherhood. That was an Islamic organization of resistance to colonialism and to secular rule, and in the context of Palestine, resistance to Israeli occupation. In its first years, it was welcomed by the Israeli state and, in fact, have funded for some years by Israel because it was seen as less threatening than the secular nationalism of the PLO, which was the leading Palestinian organization. And it has remained that way. They are not part of the PLO, it's been a separate organization. They won the elections, the Palestinian elections in 2006. It was an odd, very difficult period. It was right after the Israeli war in Lebanon of 2006, and at the same time, there had been a vicious war against Gaza at that same time. And in that context, Hamas won the election in Gaza and won significant parts of it in the West Bank. So they were and remained very popular. They're not as popular now, I would say, but they are a recognized part of Palestinian society, although there's a lot of disagreement with some of their tactics and a number of other parts to it.
Well, the other question I want to ask you, and this is from section two, what was the effect of the Arab Spring on Israel and Palestine?
Ooh, that's a complicated one. The Arab Spring is the set of uprisings that that began at the end of 2010 and really took shape throughout 2011 and 2012 in a number of Arab countries that aimed to overthrow long-standing
It
dictatorships.
started in Tunisia.
Started in Tunisia when it started with a vegetable seller who was for the nth time, who knows how many times before, had been mistreated by the local police, who turned over his cart.
I want to add something there. If I'm not mistaken, the police was a policewoman.
He was a policewoman. Yes, that's true. Tunisia is and was a very secular country. I'm not sure that was that relevant, but it was certainly true. I don't know anything about the individual politics of the man who started it, but he was mistreated again. His cart was overturned. He was humiliated by the police, and at a certain point, he had had enough, and he set himself on fire and killed himself in protest. And the act of protest spread across the country, not in the sense of self-immolation, but it became an instant uprising, and then spread to half a dozen or more other countries across the Arab world. The most successful, and of course, on the one hand, was both Tunisia, that overthrew an existing government, brought into power an Islamist government, which has been contending for power ever since. And of course, in Egypt, the biggest of the Arab countries in terms of population, where they rose up and overthrew a US-backed dictator, Hosni Mubarak. That was an extraordinary thing in a popular movement. There were challenges and contradictions around it. It was partly because there was a split within the military. So the military ended up supporting the popular movement, which then meant that when there was a real election for the first time and an Islamist activist was elected president, he only survived as president for less than 2 years because the military then overthrew him and installed a military leader as another dictator. So it wasn't a permanent victory. But it did show to all the other countries where uprisings had failed, like Bahrain, or in Syria, where it resulted in a 12-year-long civil war. It did show that these kinds of popular uprisings can work, can overthrow long-standing dictatorships.
You know, there's one thing, and this links us back to what we were discussing in the first part about humanitarian aid. I was always concerned about how, remember when we were dealing with Egypt and how there was the tunnels and, concerned about people going in. How come a lot of the humanitarian aid didn't come through Egypt into Gaza?
A lot of it did.
I mean, I'm
Cavern
like
tunnels.
going on now.
Well, I think that a lot of the tunnels have been destroyed.
Okay, that's
That was a
okay.
major priority for Israel to was to
Okay.
destroy the tunnels. Can I just say one thing? The
Go ahead.
part of your question about the Arab Spring was about how it impacted Palestine and Israel. One of the ironies was that years before the Arab Spring, the Palestinians had waged what we would now call an Arab Spring, what was called then the Intifada, or at that time we didn't know there was going to be another one, so this was the first Intifada, overwhelmingly nonviolent. The symbolism of it was children with stones that they would throw at the tanks that were invading their towns and their villages and their refugee camps. And that went on from December of 1987 until it was essentially derailed by the Oslo process, which then went on for another 30 years and did not accomplish anything. But that was essentially the preliminary version of the Arab Spring that took place in the Palestinian territories.
I want to get this question in before we have to. So, I mean, I might go back looking at the time, but you say something that's been very prophetic here on page 268. You write the following: Netanyahu had long showed signs of wanting to pull the United States into directly backing and participating in an Israeli war against Iraq. It seems like we got pulled into another one with
With
Iran.
Iran. Well, I think that I also talk about that in the book at some point too. This has been a long-standing goal of Netanyahu since 1992. CNN recently, somebody compiled the CNN clips, only CNN, the clips of Netanyahu going back to 1992. It's only a few more weeks before Iran gets a weapon. It's only going to be 6 months. It's only going to be a year. It's only going to be 3 weeks. And nobody ever called him on it. Said, like, aren't you like the boy who cried wolf?
Right.
Over and over again, this claim that Iran is going to have a nuclear weapon if you don't go to war, if you don't bomb them. And it never happened until now when it did. There's really no evidence yet that it destroyed any of their capability, but that's it's a different question.
Well, a big question that you do raise, and that's exactly, I think, is one of the last questions in your book, and that is, what happened in the U.S. presidential election of 2024?
That's a pretty hard one.
That's at the end of
I had,
the
well, I, the book was ready to go in October, and I told my publisher, we've got to wait until the election to at least react to that. Of course, this was before I saw just how dramatically horrific the situation was going to be in a second Trump administration, even compared to the first Trump administration. So I think one of the things that happened, and we know now from polling, that the single biggest reason that people who voted for Biden in 2020 did not vote for Harris in 2024. That included people who voted for Trump, people who didn't vote at all, people who voted for Congress but didn't vote for president, or people who voted for Mickey Mouse. Anybody who voted for Biden in 2020 but did not vote for Harris in 2024, the question was, what's the single biggest reason? We know there's usually many reasons, but what's the one biggest? I immediately thought, well, it's got to be the economy. That must have been the main reason. I was wrong. The main reason was Gaza. 29% of the people who voted for President Biden in 2020 did not vote for him in 2024, said the reason was his policy on Gaza, which meant continuing to fund and arm a genocide. 26%, it was the economy. I was stunned by that. And I had, I had understood the uncommitted movement. And I think that's a lesson that people cannot take for granted, that no one ever lost an election because they were too pro-Israeli. Joe Biden's partner, Kamala Harris, was the first to lose an election because of that. Now, that was only obviously in certain places. It probably would not have been enough to overcome the other reasons that they didn't vote for Harris. But nonetheless, it was a huge, huge factor. So one thing we have to keep in mind was that lesson. Will the Democrats l learn that lesson? We don't know. We can see from yesterday's election in New York that the people have learned that lesson.
Well, let's look at that. I mean, the candidate there was saying that if Netanyahu came to New York, he would ask for him to be arrested because
Exactly. Because there is a warrant out for his arrest.
right. But let me ask you this question. If for example, we're looking at the Democrats trying to reclaim, like, say, the House of Representatives in the next election, 2026, will this issue of Palestine and Gaza, will that one emerge again in, on certain local areas?
I would imagine so. There are 77% of Democrats say they want no more arms to Israel. That's unprecedented. It's extraordinary. We fought in years back. We fought to get 25%, 77%, more than three quarters of Democrats saying that. And this was also true during the Biden year when there was a Democrat in the White House. So it is clearly a very important issue for them. In a new poll, just looking at the shifts in the Jewish community, and Jews are an important component of the Democratic base in some cities, in Florida, in New York, Los Angeles. That's the most important, but those are big population centers where it matters. 30% of Jews, this was just a couple of weeks ago, say Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. And 38% of young Jews say that.
Okay, let's put the Jews aside
Okay.
and just for a moment and
Okay.
deal with a question that you raise in section three of your book. What role do the Israel lobby organizations play in setting U.S. policy? We got the Jews, but
Huge.
here's a lobby.
Right. The lobbies represent in many ways the most right-wing sectors of the Jewish community in the US and the Israeli policymakers in Israel. There are others, but the big lobbies are, whether it's the Jewish lobbies or the Christian lobbies, all are more supportive of the far right. They have more of a base in the Republican Party these days than among Democrats. So that how that plays out, I mean, we'll have to see like who the candidates are going to be, whatever. But there's no question. The role of the lobbies is key because in periods where the strategic ties between the US and Israel, which were particularly important and strong during the Cold War years, and then again during the years of the so-called global war on terror. But in between, there's periods like the 1990s, which was in between the Cold War and the global war on terror. The strategic relationship was not that important. So in those years, the lobby's role becomes even more important because they're making up for the loss of strategic concern. You know, the link, this so-called special relationship between the US and Israel started in the Pentagon. Started in the Pentagon right after the 67 war. So that's always been a key po component of it. But the lobbies deal with the political part, and that's important too. So they will remain very, very influential. Their influence is much less now when you have organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace, which now has, I think, somewhere around 60,000 members. It's extraordinary.
You also have the Heritage Foundation. It's getting to the end of our program. You also have the Heritage Foundation, pretty much saying, okay, if anybody's going to mention Hamas or in any way, we're going to talk about anti-Semitism. And so they sort of drive that wedge.
This is a very explicit plan using what the Heritage Foundation wrote, another thing that's
The Esther report, I think it is.
the Esther Project, Project Esther,
Project.
which calls explicitly for using the charge of anti-Semitism as a way of attacking and destroying the Palestinian rights movement, not only for its own sake, because they don't agree with that, but because they see it as the low-hanging fruit in going after all progressive movements. As we've seen, all the people who are being picked up in the attacks on immigrants started with the people who were immigrants who might have been supportive of Palestinian rights. So it's making that link and then using the false claim of anti-Semitism by equating any criticism of Israel to being ipso facto anti-Semitic, which of course is not true. But if you say that and get enough city councils and state assemblies and the Congress and the US Department of Education to accept that that's the definition of anti-Semitism is to be critical of Israel in ways that you're not critical of another country. Well, no other country right now is committing genocide that I know of. So yeah, we're going to criticize Israel differently.
Okay,
That's not the
the
definition.
last question, Phyllis Bennett. What is the Institute for Policy Study doing in response to this? We just mentioned the Heritage Foundation. I remember when we used to play softball together, you know. But what is the response of IPS?
IPS is an extraordinary institution that, among other things, gives incredible support to people like me and my co-director of my project at IPS, Corey Peterson-Smith, who are working these days 24/7 on issues around Israel-Palestine and changing U.S. policy on this issue. Advocacy, mobilization, working with movements. We're doing three, four webinars every day, helping people sort of sort out what they think about this and how to use it to plan their strategies of mobilizing. How to, and one of the key
But
questions.
then the question is, why, when I pick up the New York Times, I see this big thing on the Earth Report, but I don't see anything in terms of IPS on that level.
Well, because here I am on WPFW instead of the New York Times. That's why. We do get a lot of press. We don't get a lot of press in the New York Times and the Washington Post. There's obvious reasons for that, and we're not going to take the time right now to talk about that. But what is true is that we work, one of the big things we do is to work with movements whose primary work is climate justice, racial justice, immigrant rights, labor rights, internationalism. And in all these organizations, that their main work is on the domestic issue, right? Their main work is here. We're helping them to figure out what are the links. So for all of that, we're looking at what does it mean that when the US last year spent almost $18 billion of our tax money, how many people could have gotten health care for that money? how many kids could have gotten into Head Start with that money?
Right.
So this is where you see the intersection between domestic and international
issues. And this is where we see the important work that you, Phyllis Benner, has been doing for many, many years. And I want to thank you for being my guest. My guest today has been Phyllis Benner. We've been talking about her new book, Understanding Palestine and Israel. The show is On the Margin. My name is Yael Burt Miller. The station is WPFW 89.3 FM.
While Medgar Evers and Patrice Lumumba were not personally acquainted, their lives and struggles are often commemorated together due to the parallels in their commitment to fighting for the self-determination and liberation of African people. WPFW celebrates the centennial of this parallel vision with From Mississippi to the Congo, 100 Years of Lumumba and Medgar, Wednesday, July 2nd, noon until midnight on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The Birchmere presents Pieces of a Dream, June 27th, Joshua Redman, June 29th, Omar, July 17th, and Hubert Laws, July 20th. Details at birchmere.com.
Equal Portions is delighted to join Jazz and Justice Radio, WPFW, every Monday at 1 p.m. We're talking everything food justice, interviewing folks across all sectors, and playing the hottest new DMV music with your host, Stacia Lamira.
Hey, y'all. On Equal Portions, we'll be discussing all aspects of the way we interact with food, from the problems affecting our communities to the history and the story of the food around us and the local individuals within the food community. That's Equal Portions, Mondays at 1 p.m. on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, this is Jim Byers, host of the Latin Flavor Classic Edition. For nearly five decades, support from listeners like you has kept WPFW's wheels rolling. In fact, the single largest category of donations comes from those who donate an unused car to the station. That's right, running or not. Even a car sitting idle that needs thousands of dollars in repairs can do wonders for WPFW. If you can't drive it, donate it. WPFW will get the proceeds, and you'll get a tax break. Go to WPFWFM.org or call 1-866-WPFW-CAR. That's 1-866-973-9227 for more information. Help WPFW continue building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Still, it's a real good bet, the best is yet to come.
Hi, this is Robin Holden, the proprietor of Robin's Place, every Friday evening from 7 until 10 p.m. Robin's Place is a mythical entertainment center consisting of four floors. On each floor of Robin's Place, we have rooms that are named after people who I think are icons in music, theater, and literature. We have the Nancy Wilson Room, the Joe Williams Room, the Gloria Lynn Room, the Frank Sinatra Room, the B.B. King Blues Room, the James Baldwin Library, just to name a few. Join me Friday nights from 7 until 10 p.m. as I take you on a musical journey you'll never forget. Robin's Place.
Come the day you fly, I'm gonna teach you to fly.
On Monday, June 30th, WPFW presents The House That Wanda Built 2025, our annual Pride special programming.
From 2 p.m. until midnight, WPFW will broadcast voices from the Inside Out Collective and beyond, discuss issues affecting the LGBTQIA+ community, and present music from the Anthology of Booty and the Ladies Room, honoring the life and legacy of Washington, D.C.'s beloved Black lesbian activist Wanda Alston. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The WPFW Local Station Board's Relocation Committee is in the process of re-envisioning what studio space for a progressive, community-based, and community-supported radio station should be in the coming decade or more. We wish to ensure that a new, more permanent home will meet current needs and those less foreseeable in the future. All WPFW stakeholders, listeners, donors, programmers, staff, community activists may share their thoughts and insights about the future space by taking